Hello and welcome to the Recon Rod. I'm Dane Cash.
And I am world champion Cosmo Catalano.
Well, what are you world champion in?
It felt good. It felt
podcasting?
Right.
We're world champion podcasters.
This is the world champion. We could be.
Yeah. We need a rainbow jersey behind the mic here.
I suppose if we had just shown up at Qatar, we could claim uncontested victory in the world championships of podcasting.
I feel like if we even announced it briefly on Twitter, there would be other podcasters that would show up. But we are here to talk about, as you may have deduced, the World Championship Road Race. It's our final race preview of the season.
The elite men's World Championship.
Fair enough.
There are many world champions. They've been going on since last weekend. We've had people
complain.
We're not
here to talk about the Junior Time Trial Championship.
Won by an American.
Yeah. We're here to specifically talk about the men's elite road race in Doha, Qatar.
We had people complain on Twitter that we hadn't done a recon ride on this. And I was like, guys, it's like literally a week away. You know?
Yeah.
Come on.
And I just don't know that we can preview every single world championship race because there are numerous races here. Sunday's race, though, it's the last preview we're going to do this season in the middle of October, which is a little bit weird, a little bit late. But hey, at least it means I don't have to see cyclocross on the front page of every cycling media outlet just yet.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
that's nice. Get to stave that off.
Who wants to see fans? Who wants to see those?
Who wants enjoyment or anything like that on the road?
Who wants elevation changes?
Yeah,
who wants a beer tent? Beer garden?
I prefer a flat desert with no fans. Thank you.
Yeah. With no fans and ambiguous changes to the first 100 some odd kilometers of the race. Did that ever get sorted out?
We still don't know. We're going to find out, you know, probably on race day.
They can if they feel like they have to, but they're sticking with that 257.3 for now.
I think it's going to depend. If it's a zillion degrees on race day, they could certainly change it.
You know, I think there have been editions of the actual multi-day tour of Qatar that have not been 257.3 kilometers in length.
You make a good point.
I'm probably wrong about that, but it's just a long way to go.
It is, but you know, it's a one-day race, and they want it to be world championship caliber, so they're going to make it really long. And I get that. It's just it's kind of hot.
It's hot and it's flat, and I really hope it's windy and not like – I hope it's like kind of mildly windy, and then it gets really windy, you know, between 60 and 0 kilometers to go so that it feels and unwinds like a more regular race. Because I have deep concerns, especially with a world championships field where you have you do not have the reliability of the same set of trade teams. You have a huge range of talent, a huge range of strength within individual teams. I just am very worried that this could be kind of dull and maybe not so interesting.
I think it's a high likelihood of that even. I think everybody's rooting for wind. Don't know how much it's going to really play into things. I mean, even during tours of Qatar and Dubai where there have been wind, it hasn't often made a difference. Sometimes it has, but I would say it needs to be pretty heavy wind. I think otherwise we're going to be stuck with a kind of a boring race, and that's okay. I'm okay with there being a sprinter's race, a flat sprinter's race every few years.
I would say it's necessary. Sprinting is a big part of cycling, and I think it would be unfair to not throw a less elevation-heavy parkour in every now and then.
Yeah, I think sprinkling one of these in every so often, as long as it's long enough to present some challenge so that it's not just a heads-up sprint for a rainbow jersey, and this is long enough. Then I'm okay with it. I don't need it to be in a place that has a strong cycling history. I'm fine theoretically with it being in Qatar, even if we don't, you know, typically think of Qatar as a cycling oriented country.
It is at least on the same supercontinent as most cycling races, which you could not say about Richmond, Virginia. Although there were cobblestones there. Are there cobblestones in this?
I as far as I know, there's no real cobbles.
I feel like Qatar, if they really wanted to, could have put some cobbles out.
I mean,
this race.
The second half of the race is taking place on an artificial island, so if they can do that, they can probably put a couple of cobblestones in the road on said artificial island. I don't need hills. I don't need cycling history, really, but fans, real fans, are important, and some semblance of a well-run organization is important. And apparently, from what we've seen, there's a bit of a lack of both of those. And I think that's been the main concern here, is that there's not enough fans on the side of the road, and it seems like the organizers are a little tone deaf to concerns of the heat, to concerns of the sport being sort of lumped in with soccer right now, which is also hosting its own big, you know, global competition nearby. And I think that's where a lot of people are having problems with this race. But I do think from a race standpoint, I'm fine with it being boring.
I mean, do you think it's the, in terms of logistics, do you think it's that much different from the problems we seem to run into fairly regularly in Spanish racing, where you've got motorcyclists who clearly don't understand how to ride in a peloton, where you've got, you know, road bollards sticking up in the final kilometer of races? Like, it,
I don't think it's drastically different. I think it's maybe a little bit worse because of the heat. And because
that is true, yeah.
But no, I don't think it's drastically different. At the same time, I think people complained pretty heavily about the instances in Spain that we've seen these last 2 years. And I think that that is fairly applied here as well. Anytime we see video, and we have this week, of ambulances out on the road and that sort of thing, it's just what a lot of people expected. And it's kind of unfortunate. So last year, I was actually able to get to Richmond to cover things in person, but Qatar just a little bit further away from either Cosmo or myself.
Your flight would have been nicer, though. Longer. Well, actually, no, because you didn't fly.
No, I drove, so it was the flight would be just a little bit longer than the non-existent flight I took to Richmond. Fortunately, Andrew Hood of Velo News is on the ground in Doha, and he was cool enough to chat with us, to give us an idea of what things are like on the ground right now in Doha, Qatar. So let's hear a little bit from Andrew Hood. Andy, hey, how's Doha?
Ashalom from Doha. I'm in the middle of a concrete mess of towers that appear to be empty. But other than that, just great.
So we've seen this on TV. It's looks like there's not a whole lot of fans out there on the road. Is that about right?
Yeah, that is right. It's like someone dropped a neutron bomb, going back to my childhood days of nuclear fear. And basically, you know, the building stayed intact and all the humans have been destroyed. So that's the way it actually appears around here. But I mean, anybody with a half a brain cell wouldn't be outside in this heat in the middle of the day. That's kind of what, you know, the town comes alive, you know, nights and mornings. That's kind of, you know, the way it is. And that's kind of the way it is in Spain or anywhere in the world where it's hot. So, yeah, but actually there were some more folks out on the road today near the finish. You know, lots of Norwegians and Belgian fans. Well, not a lot, but, you know, some made the long trek to Qatar to watch their favorite son's race today, the first road race of the world.
So talking about, you know, how hot it is it really that hot there? It gets pretty hot at the Vuelta and at the Tour of California sometimes, too. So.
Yeah, you know, actually today it was markedly cooler than it was. It's been kind of a slow, kind of a cooling trend. We're talking, you know, a couple of degrees, but it kind of takes the edge off the day. It was real hot for the time trials. And I think the time trials were more intense of an effort, of course. You know, it's all in for whatever, 40 minutes. Right. You can barely even take a drink of water. So on the road race, at least bottles were going to pass through. At least in today's U23 race, the guy said they were getting water bottles. They were doing what they could. But yeah, I mean, it's hot. There's no question about it. But it's, you know, like a lot of guys have said, though, it's just as, like as you just said, too, it's been as hot at the Vuelta. It's been as hot at Tour of California, even when we've seen hot stages like this at the Tour de France. So, we'll have to see what happens on race day the next coming few days for the men's and women's elite races.
Have you gotten a sense of whether the wind might have an impact? We often see that in the desert races.
Yeah, it's been odd. I've only been here a couple of days, and the wind has not been kicking up at all. There was a little bit of a breeze today, but in that zone there, that Pearl Doha area, it is quite protected. There's a lot of buildings there. I mean, it certainly gets some gust and it might be a little bit open to the wind, but, you know, we'll have to see really what happens on the Sunday when the men, you know, hit that section on the desert, because if it does kick up, like you said, the Tour of Qatar, you know, echelons are part and parcel of that race. And I think this kind of late season kind of mixed up peloton, you know, with a lot of different sized teams, a lot of different nations, echelons could definitely be in the cards if the wind kicks up.
You mentioned the Pearl, and if you look at the map, the Pearl Island looks really technical. Is that a scale thing? Is it actually pretty easy, or does it seem in person as hard as it looks on a map? Because it looks like it could be a crit style crash fest towards the end of that race.
Yeah, I was talking to a few of the U23 guys today, and some of the pros. We caught them after they did their first recon, and definitely, I mean, it's kind of a nonstop pitch and turn there with the way the course is set up. A lot of those traffic circles you see in the maps are kind of like half circles. They're not a full kind of, the roads are quite wide. It's not like a narrow kind of French style, Belgian style, Dutch style roundabout. So a lot of the guys were describing them almost more like chicanes, you know, kind of a sweep and a turn, as opposed to doing a kind of a full on closed curve through a roundabout, like maybe European style. But as you saw even today at the end of the U23 race, definitely kind of that U-turn there with about, what was that, 3.5K to go, and some more switchbacks, some more roundabouts there. Technical, definitely the word, as well as positioning. It's going to be a dogfight there, I think, in that last lap for positioning.
Yeah. Are you seeing sprint as an almost certainty?
Yeah. Talking to Jim Miller, the USA Cycling coach, he was saying that he thought if it is hot for the women's race, that a group could go away. The teams aren't quite as big and strong, perhaps, on the women's side on that road race. And he thinks a group could, the pack will split up and maybe a group will go and there might not be the legs to chase it down. So he's telling his riders on Saturday to really be alert and follow moves, especially in that last kind of hour of racing. If anything goes, be on it. Whereas I think the general sensation, general feeling, just getting from talking to people around the pits, is that they think it's going to be a sprint on Sunday. But, does that mean it's the entire peloton? Probably not, but it'll probably be a fairly big size group coming in for that last lap or two, I think.
Sure.
And a very important question to close things out here. How are the facilities for the journalists and riders there in Qatar?
Yeah, I mean, it's world class here at Qatar. I mean, they got money to burn. They took a few of us journalists today and this morning on a tour of the medical facility. And, that would put to envy a lot of places, maybe across Europe and even in the States, just in terms of a mobile facility they've set up there right at the finish line. They have really, top level facilities here. I mean, the whole road course is fenced, all the pavement's smooth, and, it's really, Qatar has the money to put on these kinds of events. And for them, it's a prestige event, There's some talk of them trying to ferment a cycling culture here in Qatar, but I really don't think that's the reason why they're doing it. Of course, I think it's, if that happens, maybe for them, great. But, I think these kinds of countries, the Dubais, so now we're seeing the Omans and the Qatars, they're doing this for larger reasons than cycling. And, if cycling can hitch its wagon onto these well-funded emirs and sheiks and why not? I mean, it's there's not a lot of money in cycling these days, so I think there is some rationale, that supports getting behind these events. And maybe it's a one-off having the Worlds here in Qatar, and it's interesting. It offers some new challenges. It's going to be a flat course, won't be the most exciting race perhaps, but why not? I mean, it's a sprinter's opportunity. I think the guys that have the chance to win are taking this very seriously.
Yeah, right. Awesome. All right, Andy, thanks so much for the expertise that you always bring. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for the call.
So that was Andy Hood giving us an idea of how things are at the moment in Qatar. And I think we're ready to talk a little bit more in depth about this this route, insofar as one can talk about this route.
As much as we know.
In depth. Let's talk route. The Doha Qatar World Championship Road Race, at least for the elite men, is supposedly going to be just over 257 kilometers. And that takes place across two distinct sections of road. First, they go a pretty long ways outside of Doha, kind of through the desert. And then they arrive on the Pearl Island and they take 15.2 kilometer laps through an island circuit before arriving at the finish line. Typically, we talk about these things in terms of a profile, but I don't really know if that's a fair term to describe this route because there's really no topography to speak of. It's just a ride.
I don't understand. Can you imagine the poor designer who gets stuck with, you know, making the official profile for this race? You know, it's just if you Google it, I'm sure you'll find it. And it's literally just like a gray line with a bunch of dashed lines going through it with, you know, Lusail Sports Complex, Doha Golf Club, Piazza Arabia. There's just not a whole lot in terms of up and down that's going to have any impact on this race.
Yeah, I mean, even with Hamburg, they find a small climb to go over. This is apparently there were no overpasses even to throw in here because this is pretty flat. But
there's a lot of left and right, you know.
There is, yeah.
And it's interesting because it's not going to be, at least from what I can tell, looking at Google Earth, it's not going to be a Belgian technical. It's going to be a very recently built stuff, kind of wide, clean, smooth roads. It's like almost like the world championships of office park crits after 150K and with a 70K criterium. It's a lot of sweepers, a lot of quick corner. It's not really comparable to, I think, anything else on the World Tour circuit in terms of technicality.
Yeah, as Andy kind of mentioned, these roads are wide, so they're not like Amstel, where you have road furniture everywhere, narrow roads, or Belgium, where you have these, you know, tiny little country roads. But there's a lot of turns, a lot of twists, and they're going to be going really fast. That's the other thing. It's not going to be taken slowly. These are going to be quickly taken turns, and I think comparing it to a crit, I mean, that's what I, the first thing I think of, and I wouldn't be surprised to see some serious crashes, especially if it's really hot, because as we've seen so far already at Worlds, you know, people lose their concentration pretty quickly when they're suffering from heat exhaustion, and that can really come into play here. Although that's assuming that it's hot, and it hasn't been quite as hot these last couple of days. Andy was pointing this out. So this weekend, if it's hot but not extremely hot, we could get a pretty standard sprint one day here, and I wouldn't be surprised if, for all the brouhaha and the polemica about the heat, if it is just, after all, a pretty typical 250 kilometer sprinters race. So, speaking of sprinters, let's actually talk about this start list. I'm looking at the world start list, and I see four riders probably worth starting off this conversation.
I'm looking at this outline. It says the big three, plus the defending champion.
Okay. So that's the thing. To me, there's the three top sprinters, and then there's the guy already in rainbow. And Mark Cavendish, Marcel Kittel, and Andre Greipel, those are the big three. They've been the big three for the last several years now. And then Peter Sagan, the guy who is trying to defend his title, probably not quite as quick in a pure sprint, but we've seen him do some pretty impressive things so far. To me, those are the big four guys to start off this conversation, and I think you can start with any one of them. I'll kick it off with Mark Cavendish. He's done it before. That's big to me. He's already won a world championship. He's had a great year this year. Tour de France for Mark Cavendish this year was very impressive, especially when a lot of people, myself included, were expecting him to kind of have lost a step. And he really showed that he's still got it. And this course, to me, it's Mark Cavendish friendly. He doesn't mind technical. He doesn't mind twists and turns. He's one of the most impressive, maybe ever, at winding up his sprint in traffic and just darting through and getting up to that impressive top speed he has, even in some hectic circumstances. And I think he could do really well here at this finish, especially with the form he's shown this year, although it has been a little while since we saw that Tour de France level form. So that's my only question is, how's he doing now in October? Not really something he's used to, I would say, preparing to go this well this late in the season.
I mean, he's had, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's had some pretty good results in 6 days, which are not specifically this time of year, but also not the conventional regular season.
I think he's certainly had good results in 6 days. I just kind of, I wonder how much of a relation that has with road racing and the rigors of a 250 kilometer race as opposed to, you know, a couple of K total on the track.
My big question here is really how this sprint is going to look. His previous world championship was very much, you know, almost a perfectly regimented, executed team effort, classic sprint, took it, beautiful, hugs all around for Great Britain. I don't know if that's going to happen here. It's definitely a weirder course, a stranger place. I remember in watching the World Championships in Madrid in 2005, which was also more or less a sprinter's race, although it was close at the end. It was not your typical field sprint. It was really broken up. You had a late catch. You had there was definitely a group, but it was very strung out. It's the World Championships is not going to lend itself, I think, in these conditions as readily to that, you know, let's lead it out for Cav thing that brought him victory at Worlds the first time.
I definitely agree. My thing for the thing that makes me kind of favor Cavendish here is that of the guys at the very top, I think he's going to be the best in that scenario. Because to me, Andre Greipel can sometimes be a little timid in that kind of finale.
Yeah, he's definitely not. He's not the. I think Andre Greipel enjoys his life and does not, you know, put it on the line lightly. We've definitely seen him kind of back off on a lot of hard corners, like within the final 300 meters of a race. That said, he's still very good at multiple accelerations leading into a sprint, but he's also on a really good team. There are a lot of options on that German squad. Well, I mean, there's more than one option.
I think having two of the best options in the world counts for a lot. I kind of wonder which Marcel Kittel we're going to see in this race. Supposedly he's going to have a quote-unquote wild card role. You tend to hear that more with somebody like Nicky Terpstra, somebody who can attack. Marcel Kittel is not going to attack 100K from the finish. What's he going to do in the sprint? Is he going to try to lead Greipel out, or is he going to try to sort of freelance on somebody else's wheel? At his best, I personally think Marcel Kittel is the fastest rider in the world, but we haven't seen that Marcel Kittel in some time. It's been a while.
Didn't we get a little bit of him at the Giro, and then he showed up at the Tour looking real beat?
Yeah, but Mark Cavendish wasn't at the Giro, so I kind of wonder just how strong he really was.
Fair.
When they've gone head to head in the last, you know, year and a half, it just hasn't been the same as the Marcel Kittel we saw back in 2014, 2013, when he was just dominating at the sprints.
I hear Germany in wildcard. I go right to John Degenkolb because he's a guy who can sprint, but he can do a lot of other stuff too. He's very talented. He's very just a, you know, beastly rider with a pretty good tactical sense. You know, he did win Roubaix and he did kind of win it by just sort of hanging in, but also like there's more to hanging in than just sitting in there at Roubaix. Like you got to know what gaps to close. What
moves
to follow.
He bridged a serious gap in that race.
Yeah. So this is like, you know, this could be his kind of jam. He's been very quiet all season coming back from that terrible crash, learning to sprint with an immobilized finger, which I have 10 mostly functional fingers, and working a shift lever in a sprint and a brake lever coming into a sprint are things that I do not do well. I can't imagine what that adjustment is like. So he may have kind of learned some new ways to work his advantages in the closing sections of bike races.
Indeed. Peter Sagan being the other of these big four guys we're going to talk about, I think he is going to be in a similar situation to that in which Degenkolb's going to find himself. He's probably not the fastest in the pure sprint, but we've seen this time and time again that he's been able to win races like this.
Yeah, Quebec comes to mind for me. Like he played Van Avermaet like a tune, and it was a very, I think, a similar sprint line as you might see here. There was a lot of disorder very late. You had a Rigoberto Urán, who's super strong, who's won that race before, really get a huge gap on the field, and Sagan was just sitting, and then right when he needed it the most, you know, had that surge, got around, took the victory. Not quite as spectacular as his win at Richmond last year, but I think there is not going to be that same opportunity to really manipulate your ability to handle a bike like he did in the Richmond finale. Here, it's going to be a lot more just going off sense, which isn't something he always does well, but I think at Quebec really showed that he can do it.
Yeah, and I think the thing to remember here is that people, they often overlook his top end speed just because he's so good at everything else, but he's really fast, and he's not won the pure sprints at the Tour at the same level that the Cavendish, Greipel, and Kittles have, but he's certainly done it at the same level as some of the second tier guys, and I think he's fully capable of beating a lot of the guys of the second tier. And if Cavendish isn't on a great day, if, you know, Greipel's a little timid in the sprint, he's one of the best sprinters in the world, even if he's good at everything else too. Certainly capable of winning this race and defending that title.
Yeah, I mean, the corners aren't going to hurt him. Like, yeah, he's good on bikes.
That's definitely true.
But that descent and that uphill, Richmond wind was so good.
And it was really well made for him too. Yeah. Also, I think it also proved, and this will be true here this year, what we've seen the last several years at the World Championships, Rui Costa, Mikhail Kwiatkowski, Peter Sagan, all coming from teams that were not powerhouses. Not that they didn't work for
Kwiatkowski had a million dudes, to be fair.
It wasn't like he had well-known riders supporting him. The Polish team was not a team of superstars, even if they were very hardworking that day, just like they were at the Olympics for Rafał Majka, for that matter. They weren't a team of superstars like Belgium and Germany are going to have in this race. And I think they've shown these last couple of years, Portugal, Poland, Slovakia, you don't need to have a team of superstars to win a world championship. You can freelance your way to a victory. Despite all of the hoopla that is made over how strong these teams are, you really can win a world championship without having John Degenkolb and Marcel Kittel as your backups. And I think that's gonna be helpful for Sagan, just that fact that you don't necessarily need that kind of team support to win a world title. Let's talk about some of these other names that are going to be hoping to overhaul some of the top favorites. I think it's worth starting with Alexander Kristoff, who has had a quieter year than I expected, but certainly still dangerous in a long day ending in a sprint.
He's really shown his ability to race that sort of tactically broken up race where he really has to close gaps. He has to take his initiative. He can't just sit on and sprint from 250 meters away, which he's very, very good at when he's on form.
Yeah, and he's also got Edvald Bosenhagen riding for Team Norway, just in case, for whatever reason, he doesn't make it to the finish. So they've got a good squad here. Fernando Gaviria, to me, is going to be the most exciting rider to watch, because we just don't know what to expect in a one-day race like this. We know he's very fast. We unfortunately were sort of robbed of a chance to see him. Well, he robbed us himself of a chance to see him in a big sprint in a one-day at Milano-San Remo. But before that race, I didn't really expect him to go very well in a 250k plus race, just because he hadn't done it before. But he made it to the end of Milano-San Remo. Well, he made it to the final kilometer of Milano-San Remo. So if he can do that, I'm assuming he can do it again here. And I think he's fast enough to beat anybody on this start list on a good day. So it's going to come down to how he's feeling on the day, how everybody else is feeling on the day. But I think he's fully capable of bringing home a world championship for Colombia, which is... Oh, it would just be kind of ironic if Gaviria were to bring home a rainbow jersey for Colombia on the flattest worlds possible, for a country that is so well known for being a climber's paradise.
And I mean, Gaviria is like my dark horse. He is so Paris-Tours. He basically did like a 700 meter sprint. Like, yeah, it was technically a late attack, but he went really hard for 700 meters from the front of the field, and nobody caught him.
Yeah, like, I had to write a race report for that, and I had to get really creative with the headline, the title. You know, is it a sprint? What do I call this? Because it's not your traditional sprint, that's for sure. Yeah. But it wasn't it was a 5K attack. It was somewhere in between, and it really proved just how strong he is.
Yeah, I mean, I can't look at that and be like, yeah, but you know, he's not going to be a contender at Worlds. Like, I don't even know how he did. The only thing I can think of that compares to that is back, what, like 2007? Like, Cancellara basically just soloed out of the front of the group right as they were about to catch a small breakaway. And, you know, there was some disorder there, but it's basically Cancellara in the hoods just hammering away and winning a stage. Like, it's that kind of, it doesn't make sense that this happened, but it did, and we saw it. And if I were Cavendish, I would be extremely worried about this.
Especially, yeah, Cavendish knows just how strong he is, because he rode together with him before he switched over to Dimension Data. So I would be definitely, if I were him or Marcel Kittel, who's ridden with him this year, be concerned about Fernando Gaviria.
Speaking of none of those things, how do I segue into the French team? You know, it would have been a better segue from Germany if we were going to talk about the French team, but they have a lot of options. Nasser Bouhanni, I think, is probably the top guy, and certainly the one with the biggest chip on his shoulder. I think he's had some fair relegations and some unfair relegations. Either way, he's a guy who has a lot of pressure on him to get a big win in. He's got a strong French team behind him, and Arnaud Demar and Brian Cocard could be equally dangerous. It really depends, I think, on how each of them is doing kind of in the race, how they're feeling, because it's going to be such an unusual event in such unusual conditions. Buhani's a guy who I've maybe in the past said couldn't handle distance, but he's got some good finishes at San Remo, although Demar has won San Remo, which is a better finish than those finishes. But I think it really goes to show it's going to kind of be down, you know, game time decision, as game time as in like the final couple kilometers of this race, who is going to be sprinting for France. Similar situation, I think, with the Australian team, where you have two riders who are both very quick. They've both shown good results. Matthews has been up there at, again, longer races at San Remo. Ewan's just been really good recently. But they're also, like, I don't know, Ewan is younger. I don't know if he's shown good distance ability, but Matthews, I think, is really coming into prime. My guess is they'll be behind him, although I haven't been following the information coming out of the team, so maybe there's... I hope there's not any conflict, but...
There has been in the past with Matthews and Gerrans, so... be a surprise.
Was that Matthews? Was that Gerrans? Who knows?
I'm also thinking another dynamic duo potential in Giacomo Nozzolo and Elia Viviani. Italy with two of those really good second-tier sprinters. Nozzolo in particular has shown an affinity for longer one-day, you know, technical circuit races. He always does really well in the... He always does really well in Hamburg, Plouay, that kind of thing. Never actually wins them. But he does have a national championship on his palmarès now. And Elia Viviani, maybe slightly more successful in the top-end races, but maybe slightly less well-known for one-day prowess. Either of those guys, though, could be a contender in a sprint here. Belgium, also two options, Tom Bonin, Jens de Vucheren. You know, Bonin, I think, is going to get hyped up pretty heavily because we're racing in the desert, where he tends to do pretty well. He's also Tom Bonin. He's a, you know, former world champ himself. But personally, I'd be very surprised to see him sprinting at the same caliber as some of these other names we've mentioned.
No, that'd be crazy. I mean, 11 years between world championship titles.
That's a pretty long time to go. The Netherlands as well, with Danny Van Poppel and Dylan Groenewegen. So there's a lot of teams that have multiple options for the sprint. It is going to be hard, I think, to overhaul those guys at the very top, the Cavendish, Greipel, Kittel club, and maybe Sagan, Christophe Gaviria, those guys as well. And then a couple teams are coming here with some wild cards to play. I think Belgium knows that Bonin and de Vucheren are going to have a really hard time in the sprint, so I really am hoping to see Greg Van Avermaet try a long flyer, because I think that's probably their only chance in this world, is to try to sneak one over the sprinters. And who better to do it than the Olympic gold medalist?
Yeah, I mean, if you had to pick a guy to just kind of come up and win a bike race this year, Greg Van Avermaet, not a bad choice.
Yeah, and that includes Tirreno Adriatico, amazingly enough. So, yeah.
No, that would be to take the world championships in a desert shortened race after taking Tirreno Adriatico in a winter shortened race. That would be a nice little kind of bookend of the season.
Yeah, it'd be very impressive. It'd be a very impressive collection of results this year.
It'd be a tribute to humans' ability to thermoregulate.
So at least Greg Van Avermaet's ability.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's one of the things humans do, like doing really long exercise and
pretty much any other species, as far as I know.
No other species could do what Greg Van Avermaet is doing right now.
Yeah, he's his own species, really. Yeah.
You got Nicky Terpstra, a guy who did not have the strongest spring. I think he really likes the spring races. Certainly, like, that's where he's had the most success in the past, but just didn't really show up this year and has kind of been working his way in. He won Eneco, which is like the spring. It's a stage race of basically classics. And he had a great day on the last day, came away with the victory, a little bit help from his friends on stage five in the team time trial. Probably a different group of friends would have to help him here, but he's certainly very strong, and I don't think he's going to be marked. So that may be an advantage as this race kind of works its way down through those circuits on the Pearl Island thing.
Yeah, I think it's Terpstra and Van Avermaet, to me, probably the two most likely to try to sneak away. Of course, there's a few other guys here.
He's actually, I should mention this, he is a two-time GC winner at Tour of Qatar.
Yeah, he's had a lot of success in the desert. I think that's going to play to his advantage. I guess I'm also looking at Matteo Trentin, Jasper Stuyven, Jeppe Drucker, some of these other guys to maybe try to sneak away. It's going to be hard. I think it's going to be a big challenge to avoid a bunch sprint here. But yeah, Terpstra, Van Avermaet, they seem maybe most likely. And of course, Peter Sagan, maybe he's in that club as well. So those are the top favorites and some of the fringe names. What do you say we name some favorites for the last time this year? Are you ready to close the book on making predictions
this season? I'm here to do it. Let's do this.
All right, I'll kick us off. I am going to go with Mark Cavendish to win the race. I think he's the best positioned of the top sprinters here. I think he's going to be most comfortable in this finishing sprint, even if it is a little chaotic. I think he's well prepared for this, and I think he's shown really great form this year. I'll put Greipel in second, and I'll put Sagan in third. Really do expect Sagan to be up there fighting for even the win. I'm a little nervous about leaving Kittel off the podium, but I'm naming a podium, so you know I think Kittel's more likely to win the race than Sagan, but I think Sagan is more likely to be on the podium, if that makes sense. So those are my three: Cav, Greipel, Sagan.
I'm going with the big dark horse pick. I'm going with Gaviria. I can't keep him out of the finale, out of the top one spot. Like, I have these flashbacks where I wake up in a cold sweat thinking I'm watching the Perry Tour final again. He's super strong, and he's from the Southern Hemisphere. So he has done a lot of racing kind of on the off season. The lateness of this race is not going to be a problem for him. I think he could do very well here. I'm liking him for the win. I like Cavendish in second because he's really good. He's going to be focused, but I think this is going to be a very, very fast race. I don't think it's going to quite work out as well as the Tour did. And then I have Sagan in third for the reasons mentioned. Really good rider, really good at turning bikes, really strong, not necessarily the best sprinter.
You know, one thing you point out about Gaviria that's definitely worth noting, that the Southern Hemisphere aspect. I was in San Luis in January covering that race, and Fernando Gaviria has had plenty of success in San Luis. He's won stages in back-to-back years. I have never covered a bike race in heat as intense as the heat that we experienced in San Luis this year, and he's been winning races in that kind of heat for a while now. So if anybody's going to feel comfortable in this kind of heat, Fernando Gaviria, to me, is going to be that guy. So that's another thing to keep in mind, as Cosmo has rightly pointed out. So I think it's fair to say that you've set yourself up well not to wake up in a cold sweat, because I like his chances too, I have to say. But I guess we can only pick three. So those are our podiums for the World Championships. It's the last podium we're going to predict this season, which is kind of a bummer, but... It's been a long season, so
you don't want to do this for Cross.
I'm happy to enjoy Cross without making any predictions. Just watch it.
You just went on record saying you enjoy Cross.
Yeah, I just watch it every once a year, and I think that's enough for me. I'll watch Worlds. No, I'll be watching much more than that this year. But
so you're working the desk, man.
I gotta work the desk. That's right. So we will be back, though. This is not our final show. We're going to do one more show this year, just like we did last year. We're going to, quote-unquote, preview the off-season. We had a lot of fun with that last year. So one last episode to follow this one. Hopefully you enjoy the coming World Championship Elite Men's Road Race. Hopefully it's not too much of a snooze fest. And hopefully there's no ambulances on the road. Instead,
they can be on the
fans.
Road. They just need
to just
stay
not on the road
back,
in the race.
Behind,
Yeah. Fewer ambulances, more fans. How about that? That's what I'm hoping for.
I mean, it's entirely reasonable that people would just come down for the two road races, and they're the biggest
true.
Show.
Yeah,
for
those
sure.
are the
two,
big,
two elite
the,
road
the big
races.
Events. Yeah, fair enough. Hopefully those are fun, and hope you enjoy them. And we'll be back soon enough for our final episode of 2016. This has been the Recon Ride Podcast. I'm Dane Cash,
and I am Cosmo Catalano, still world champion.
And that's our show.